This is The Takeaway. I'm Arun Vanagopal, in for Tanzina Vega. Today is Martin Luther King Jr. Day, on which the country celebrates the life and the legacy of one of the giants of the civil rights movement. While Dr. King is greatly admired today, he faced hatred and mistrust in his time, including from U.S. intelligence agencies. In 1963, the FBI wrote in a memo that Dr. King was, quote, dangerous and should be, quote, marked by the agency. Years of surveillance followed, with the FBI even sending Dr. King a threatening letter, apparently urging him to commit suicide. Dr. King's surveillance wasn't unique. For years, black activists had been tracked, infiltrated, and even targeted by the U.S. government, activists including Ida B. Wells, Ella Baker, and Fred Hampton. Today, this surveillance continues. In response to the Black Lives Matter movement, law enforcement stepped up its surveillance of black activists. And in 2017, 6 months into the Trump administration, the FBI circulated a secret report warning of so-called black identity extremism. Although that specific FBI designation has changed under public pressure, advocates are still worried its replacement still leads to the targeted surveillance of black activists. So here to help us break us down, all of this down, is Malkia Debbich-Cyril, founder and senior fellow at Media Justice. Malkia, great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
So let's go through some history here. What did the surveillance of civil rights leaders look like in the 1960s and 70s?
Well, like you described, I mean, we had the counterintelligence program of the FBI. It started around 1956, and some say it was ended in 1971, but it wasn't ended as much as it was found out by a team of white activists that broke into some FBI offices and stole the papers, then known as the COINTELPRO papers, that outed the program. We're talking about a long history of covert operations against domestic political groups using methods at the time, such as wiretaps, discrediting, falsifying information, reading and sending mail falsely, setting up conflicts both between activists and between activists and police, often that ended up either with somebody dead or somebody in prison for the rest of their lives, false arrests, and other kinds of infiltration.
So how did the FBI and law enforcement rationalize the surveillance?
Well, you know, surveillance historically has been intended to monitor dissidents and police race. So they, they rationalized it by claiming, one, that the rise of a quote-unquote black messiah, that was J. Edgar Hoover's words, would threaten the national security of the United States. In fact, political dissidents, whether you're talking about the American Indian movement, you're talking about environmental activists or others, has always been framed as a threat to national security. But that's only because national security has been framed as protecting the interests of white supremacy.
Moving up to what we're seeing today, what do we know so far about the, quote, black identity extremism label from the FBI report?
The title has changed, and now they kind of just talk about identity extremists. But, you know, part of the problem with that terminology is that it both focuses on black activists while actually denying or preventing any focus on white nationalists who are actually responsible for something like 80% of domestic terrorism in the United States. There's been some, you know, FOIAs done both by Media Justice and the ACLU, Color of Change, and the Center for Constitutional Rights, and others. They found, you know, a few things. They found out, for example, the FBI was able to alert officials about a protester's plans to travel from New York to Ferguson for a protest on Thanksgiving Day a couple years ago. And the question is, you know, how did they know that? You know, what techniques have they been using to monitor black activists? And one of the problems is that we don't know, right? So that's why the FOIAs are so important. And those are Freedom of Information Act requests to find out more about how this designation is affecting the surveillance of black activists.
So have there been people arrested, or have there been any other tangible consequences of the surveillance, to your knowledge?
Well, we know that one young man his name Rakim Balogun was arrested in Texas. He's the first, you know, publicly known activist to be arrested under that designation. He was arrested, on a gun charge, on a gun possession charge. But how they came to know he had a gun in his home, begs the question, you know, he was arrested. When he was arrested, they also removed reading material from his home, reading material that would be considered, you know, radical. That is not unprecedented, but it is unusual. So, you know, so we have that arrest that we know for a fact was made under that designation. And then we have plenty of other arrests of Black activists that were improper. The fact is, though, that these programs like counterintelligence program in the 60s are done in secret. And so we know very little about how they operate. That's part of the need to investigate.
What are Black activists doing today in order to protect themselves from this sort of surveillance?
Oh, well, you know, first of all, we understand that there's no sense of real safety. That's not really possible, particularly given the technology of the day. What folks are doing is they are, turning off their geolocation on their phones when they protest. We're becoming aware of the use of Stingray devices and protecting our phones in the ways that we can. Stingray cell site interceptors, which, you know, monitor wide swaths of cell phone use, but the fact is, at the end of the day, the most secure community is an organized community. At the end of the day, there's very little that we can do technically to protect ourselves, but there's a lot we can do in terms of our behavior and how we organize and how we build relationships with one another. And that's kind of where we've seen the most focus and improvement.
And Malkia, real quick, do you think that this knowledge about surveillance has kept people away, or is it actually driving recruitment to organizations that fight for, Black rights?
You know, this isn't just about surveillance. It's about the fact that digital technologies have been used to increase the policing and imprisonment of Black people, and that is driving recruitment like never before.
Malkia Debitch-Cyril is the founder and executive director of the Center for Media Justice. Malkia, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
We asked you how you bring the ideals that Martin Luther King Jr. stood for into your own life and community.
For Martin Luther King Day, I just try to be fair and truthful to all. And this is Al from Massachusetts.
Hi, my name is Kate, and I am calling from Cleveland, Ohio. I try to respect everyone I come across. I was raised with that belief that no person is better than others. There is no difference. We are all human beings.
This is Manal calling from West Palm, and to be honest, it's hard to forget when you are aware that there are people that feel that you don't deserve the same treatment or privileges they do just because of the color of your skin. It makes no sense to me. I mean, at the end of the day, we're just all humans.
This is Erica from Brooklyn Heights, New York. I'm a union member. I work tirelessly to promote equal rights both on and off the job, and I believe in nonviolent solutions to confrontations. That's how I bring the ideals that Martin Luther King Jr. stood for into my own life.
I'm a home inspector. I inspect quite a bit in areas that have felt the impacts of neglect and poverty. Buying a home is a dream for many of these people with limited means. But houses have been badly neglected. I bend over backwards to deliver honest reports tempered with kindness. I'm trying to be as practical and compassionate in my work as possible. I don't want them to get hurt on a deal, and I also don't want to dash their dreams. I believe MLK wanted all people treated with fairness and respect, regardless of their color and many other criteria. I strive to make my corner of the world fair for all. I'm Neil Wilson in East Orange, New Jersey.
My name is Danae, and I am calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Since the 2016 election of DJT, I have been on a kindness campaign rooted in Dr. King's 1967 SCLC speech during their 11th convention. The title asks, "Where do we go from here?" His speech contains examples of 1967 social, racial, and economic injustice, eerily familiar to the 21st century. King then answers, "I have decided to stick with love, for I know that love is ultimately the only answer to mankind's problem, and I am going to talk about it everywhere I go. Some days it's easier for me to be loving and kind. Other times, evil trips up my efforts. But I look to those words of King to aid me as I embark upon the fourth year of my kindness campaign. Won't you join me?"
Please continue to call us about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
A lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.